This is a Beyond Casterbrews podcast. Available on iTunes, Audio Boom, Stitcher.com, Player FM, and BeyondCasterbrews.com.
Coaxial.
Welcome to Coaxial. I'm Christian Corley. This is Gareth Cavana.
Greetings.
That's him. And
You caught me by surprise there.
I caught you by surprise. We've been talking, but I've caught you by surprise anyway.
Yeah.
So we're here again for another Coaxial. Thank you to everyone who tuned in, downloaded our original, our prime edition.
That's our maiden.
Our maiden podcast. I think it's exactly the term I'm trying to scramble for there. Our maiden podcast, when we were talking about BBC's recent classic sitcom season. So we've had some nice feedback about that. So thank you very much to all of you who've listened and everyone who got in touch to tell us how much they liked it. And thanks to all of you who didn't like it, who didn't bother to get in touch. That's also appreciated. This time, we're looking at ITV sitcom. No, we're not. I don't want to talk about. What are we talking about, Gareth? I've forgotten.
We are talking about classic Coronation Street. Classic Emmerdale, how it's evolved over the years.
Yes.
I believe that was how you sold it to me.
That was how I sold it, yes.
Yeah.
Well,
because we do love our classic Coronation Street.
Yeah, well, they've both evolved considerably over the years.
They have.
You know, so like Coronation Street, I mean, even in so many ways, I mean, if just visually, Coronation Street's gone through a number of sets from the 1960s, hasn't it? From the time where I think they only had one set per week or per episode or whatever.
I mean, the street wasn't external. I mean, the street starts out as an interior set with the pavement lights chalked on the studio floor. And if you look at it, there's not even a curb going down to the road. It's just magically drawn. It's like, it's a bit like Mary Poppins and the pavement drawings. But yeah, I mean, gradually it evolves. Then you have a bit of an outdoor set. And you have a little bit more of an outdoor set, but no backs on the houses. So if in the early 70s you see Hilda hanging out of her first floor window screaming at Stan Ogden, she's on a ladder.
Good Lord.
She scampered up a ladder and popped through the window. And then we get our own set proper in 1984, which is the one that they were on until for 30 years.
Right.
Before moving to... So, yeah, it's definitely evolved. Not much in the way of location, although occasionally a bit of location, but the look has definitely moved through the decades.
Similarly, Emmerdale started off in a little village called Arncliffe, and then it moved to Esalt for 22 years. And then latterly, since 1997, it's been a purpose-built village set on the Harewood estate near Leeds.
That's right. Now I remember it being at Esalt because it used to be when we had our hotel in Llandudno, me and my family, you know, the coach trips, the old dears used to go out there on a day trip.
Right.
And because it was an actual village, it had an actual working wool pack that you could go in for a pint.
Mm-hmm.
So it was quite a thing actually. When you go around it now, you can't go in the wool pack for a pint, so maybe the old one was better.
I think it looked more like a village.
It did.
What you have now looks more like I'll tell you what really reminds me of is Wynyard, the Wynyard estate up here on Teesside.
Oh, this is where Keegan lives, isn't it?
Yeah, loads of the footballers or the football managers with Northeast connections live there. Yeah.
That's right, yeah. It looks like Emmerdale. I can see Kev down the wool pack.
I tell you what, those are fantastic.
Don't you go near them dingles. They're rough. They're rough, I tell you, rough.
There was a day about 20 years ago when Kevin Keegan, shortly after he took the Newcastle United job and he went out for the day, probably a bit more than 20 years now, and he was at he went to Gisborough, nearby Gisborough, which isn't far from here. And there's a well-known independent bookshop there, called, as you'll be unsurprised to learn, called the Gisborough Bookshop. And I had phone calls from about half a dozen people telling me they'd just seen Kevin Keegan in the Gisborough Bookshop.
Well, he's a brilliant bloke. I did a bit of work for him, gosh, back in 2000. So we met him, and it was extraordinary. It really was. He had this... he was England manager at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Well, actually, when we started the work, he was England manager.
Oh, right, okay.
He wasn't. And I remember we had a meeting, and we went in, and I didn't really know what to say. And he said, yeah, don't say it. It's been a very stressful few weeks, but it's over now. And he had this like secret research laboratory, almost like a Bond villain. It was like Keegan was like this brilliant Bond villain, and he was developing the technology for what went into Soccer Circus. Anyway, Kev was lovely. He was lovely. He was a little bit eccentric, but he always made the tea. And I think although Kev was a sort of outdoorsy Emmerdale man, in his heart, he was a Coronation Street man. Pot of tea on the table, fish fingers and chips, a man of simple tastes. That's where I'll go with it.
Okay. I always liked the fact about Kevin Keegan that he never considered himself to be naturally talented, and he worked really, really hard. Doing extra training and practicing.
Yeah, he was a little asthmatic kid, wasn't he?
Yeah.
From Scunthorpe, and that's right. He built himself up into a little mighty dynamo.
Yeah.
Lovely man, though. You know, good sense of humour.
Excellent. So, classic Coronation Street, anyway. Now, you're a bit of a fan of the old episodes of Coronation Street that they used to play. Do they still play them on ITV3 or... I know it was Granada Plus back in the day, wasn't it?
It was Granada Plus back then. And actually, there was a wonderful person on YouTube a user called Auntie Corrie, who very helpfully loaded all of the episodes of Coronation Street from 1976 onwards in production order. I think they've gone now, but it meant that you could literally just look one. If you remembered one, let's say you remembered Annie Walker with her monogrammed carpet, you'd look it up on Corrypedia, you'd get the date... And then you could just search Auntie Corrie and it was there. Oh, it was joyous.
Sorry, can I just stop you there? Did you say Corrypedia?
Yeah, there's a Corrypedia.
There's a Corrypedia? Excellent.
Hey, listen, Corrypedia is a serious source of academic study. Yeah, you can basically search every episode. Every single episode has a synopsis and a cast list and a crew list. You can search by writer, by member of crew, by artiste, there's year summaries. Oh, it's a serious piece of scholarship, is Corrypedia.
Interesting. Now, these old episodes of Coronation Street, they're very, particularly the 70s ones. You know, I mean, I started watching Coronation Street, well, like Doctor Who, I don't know when I started watching Coronation Street because it was, you know, it was always just on.
You don't remember a time before Coronation Street.
Exactly, pretty much so, yeah. BCS, we would have to call that. Things, you know, if you think back, you know, you've got all the fashions, you've got the rare sort of filmed exterior inserts that would appear with often Hilda Ogden having a fight with that, shouting at Elsie Tanner or some other person, or Stan, or telling Stan what to do, or whatever.
Yeah.
In, you know, those. And then you'd have the internals, which are very sort of 70s, very brown decor, but also a lot smaller than they are now.
But people did live in little houses back then.
Yeah.
It was authentic. You know, one of the problems I had, as I said last week, with the Deaf Dealer's Part sitcom recreation, is that, you know, Alf Garnett and his family were living in what looked like a Regency mansion. It was that big. You know, it needed the smallness of the front room, the simple table, the two chairs, the bottle of brown sauce, and Hilda's Muriel. That, you know, that's it. That's all you need. I did love Hilda's Muriel. It's a brilliant scene where she's that pleased. She shows to show it off. She brings Annie Walker, landlady of the Rovers, round to see it, and she goes, "Oh, what do you think of me Muriel, Mrs. Walker?" And she goes, "Oh, do you know, dear, It's that vivid. I don't think I can take it any longer. Do you mind if I turn my chair around for the rest of the conversation?
she was brilliant, wasn't she, Annie Walker?
Annie Walker is fantastic. We were chatting about her the other day. There's some great episodes. Back in 2013, when I was still at my old little pub, we did another set of live Coronation Streets, where we took an old episode, a couple of episodes, and recreated them on the ground floor of the pub. And the ones we picked were Annie's Magic Carpet, as we called it, where she has this monogrammed carpet delivered, specially monogrammed, with interlocking AWs throughout. And it's the pride of her parlour. And she's that pleased. She invites all of the Lady Victualler societies, so all these other bitchy landladies pop round for a small glass of sherry to marvel at the carpet. And 5 minutes before they're all due to arrive, Bet and Hilda let it tumble that this magic AW carpet is in fact an offcut from the Alhambra Weatherfield bingo hall. Yes, bingo carpet in my house. Oh, well, we thought you knew, Mrs. Walker. Give me credit for a little taste, Elizabeth. And then you've got this cringy 5 minutes where you're just gnawing your fingernails, where all these evil posh women are in, looking at this carpet. And she goes, oh, they're looking at it, dear. I think they've tumbled. Oh, no, I don't think so. Oh, they have. Look, they're chuckling. Oh, my word, I shall never show my face ever again at the Guildhall. And this goes on in this vein several times. There's a similar one where she's conned into buying what she believes is an art masterpiece, but it's actually a painting that Stan Ogden's done, because on the back of it is Hilda's written, "Your tea is in the oven, have gone to bingo." So it's basically this vain woman, you know, and this just goes on and on. And this is Coronation Street in the late 70s, I believe. It's the prototype only Fools and Horses. It's pretty much Fools and Horses done from the north. And that, for me, is the show at its zenith. Mm-hmm. It never gets better than that.
I do recall as a child my mum laughing at Coronation Street quite often.
Oh, it was just so funny. I remember I met John Stevenson once, who's one of the legendary writers of the 70s. And he said, well, and I just showed an episode, because we had him for a talk, mm-hmm. of Stan, Hilda and Eddie on the tip, because Hilda's put all of her best linen in a bin bag, and Stan's put it out with the rubbish. So Hilda's best linen has gone to the tip. So they're going through all these bags on the tip, inglorious external 16mm location. So they're going through everything on the tip, and Hilda's calling them for everything and calling them for everything. And then at one bit, at one part, Stan goes, "What are you moaning about, woman? I've only just found him." And she goes, "Oh, Stan. Oh, you're marvellous, Stan. Oh, I forgive everything, Stan." And he goes, "April Fool." And then the Hilda explosion is fantastic. and I said this to John, and he said, well, basically, these writers knew... They knew their characters and they knew the North, you know, and John was an ex-journalist, so he'd covered all of these communities all across the North in his work with the Daily Express before he became a writer. So he knew these very pompous civic types, you know, so he said he always loved writing for Hilda, not for Hilda, he loved writing for Hilda, he loved writing for Audrey and Alf, if you remember them.
Yeah, because he was a mayor, wasn't he?
He was the mayor.
Councillor. Yeah, he was definitely Councillor
Roberts. Yeah. And he said, I love them because I quickly boiled down how I was going to make that work dramatically is that Alf was tight and Audrey spent every penny he had. So they were constantly in conflict. And he just worked out the dynamic of these little characters, you know. And he kind of did it a little bit with Bette Lynch and Alec Gilroy, where he went, you know, Alec was tight. Bet was spendthrift. Alec was sneaky. Bet came at you from the front if she was coming for you. And I think he understood character, and I think all of the writers that era understood character, and that's why we ended up with a very rich brew. Who were your favourite characters in Corrie?
Ooh. Interesting question. Oh, I think Reg Oldsworth.
Oh, I liked Reg. Hello, Vitar.
Yeah, yeah. Jack Duckworth, even.
Jack's brilliant. Yeah.
And Hilda.
Yeah, we love
always,
Hilda.
Always enjoyed Hilda. I kind of like Norris, actually.
Oh, Norris is very popular. Very popular character. Very important character, Norris. Yeah.
Oh, and who can forget Blanche as well?
Oh, Blanche was something very special. Some of the quality of the writing she got, the she was your classic, you know. You see Blanche in the 70s, she's quite a robust battle axe, but not that memorable. Mm. When they bring her back as a sort of evil Madame Guillotine, like a sort of like a private personal torturer for Ken Barlow, it's Coronation Street at its finest. Yeah. some of the lines, some of the situations. The one where Blanche comes back from the pub after a few too many sherries and dishes it all out honestly to a horrified Barlow household. It's absolutely brilliant. Oh dear. Put that up in the show notes. That clip's up there. It's famous. Just type in Blanche Hunt drunk into YouTube. It'll be there.
I will include that one. Not a problem. And we were talking about locations before, weren't we?
Yes.
And there's another element, because obviously Coronation Street has grown, and there's always this, you know, there's this big thing about the Rover's Return, seemingly larger, being TARDIS-like, basically. It seems to be larger on the inside than it is on the outside.
Oh, it is. It's never worked. It's never
and
worked.
The famous thing about the toilets being in Ken Barlow's
house. You go into the Barlows,
Now, I thought about this, and it did occur to me that in the old days, toilets were quite small.
Yeah.
But it is possible that the toilets in the Rover's Return was basically a wall to piss against through a door. And then that was it.
What, you're just pissing into Ken Barlow's living room?
Into a drain, you know, maybe a very thin wall.
Or there's a possibility, as I've seen, I tell you what it could be. They might not be as wrong as you think. There's a possibility, because there's a pub here in Manchester called the, I've forgotten it now. It's not the Pebble or the Peak. It is the Little Grey Horse. And that's an ancient sort of two up, two down on Portland Street. Now, to go to the toilet, because the toilet actually is an old outside toilet, which is what it would have been, that they've included a corridor. So in theory, if there's a small gap between the Rovers and Ken's that you can't see, in theory, you could be going out, turning left, going down a very narrow corridor, and then going into a converted outside toilet. Mm-hmm. On the outside. So that might work. I'll tell you what there certainly isn't any room for is throughout the 60s and 70s, they had a function room on the back of the Rovers called the Select.
Oh, yes.
Which is absolutely enormous. And there's no way that fits into it. Although, in theory, in fairness, I think at the time that they used the Select, you could only see the front and side of the Rovers.
Right.
So in theory, it could be there. The minute they build the real one and open it in 1984, and there's a back alley at the back of it, no, it doesn't work anymore.
Yeah, I'd always imagined it was upstairs. But, of course, they live upstairs, so it couldn't have been upstairs. Do you remember that episode where the stairs have been taken out?
Oh, I love that.
Jack and Vera are there.
Is it Jack, or is it...
I thought it was Jack and Vera. Is it not Jack and Vera? Because they had the pub at one point, didn't they?
Oh, yeah, that's right. And they have it after Bette and Alec. Yeah, I remembered that. It's definitely Jim McDonald who's the builder. But I remembered that as being Alec Gilroy being famously tight and refusing to pay it. But whether it's Alec or whether it's Jack and Vera, it is, yeah, that's right. He comes back and removes the staircase until they pay.
Yeah. These days Coronation Street is a very different beast, isn't it?
It is.
It's there's Well, I mean, it's quite unrecognisable in many ways. But then at the same time, you do have those little amusing moments and amusing characters, like Norris, for instance.
I think the setting, which worked so well for Coronation Street 67 and 80s, is now actively working against it, whereas the setting for Emmerdale, which was very boring and agrarian for 70s and 80s, you know, it was a farming show with a little bit of action, now works, because if you, I mean, you know the area quite well. If you go to Ilkley and all these little villages around Leeds, they actually aren't far off Coronation, off Emmerdale. You know, you have a pub, but quite often it's a nice gastro pub. You have a little shop, you have all those things, but you have this fantastic mix of incredibly wealthy, posh people living cheap by jowl with people who've lived there for years and years, and people who still work the land and are a bit more rough and ready and don't drive Porsches, you know, but drive battered old Land Rovers.
Yeah.
So in a strange way, society has worked for Emmerdale and let it organically open up new dramatic possibilities in a way that makes it feel authentic. So you can have incredibly glamorous, wealthy people living in these places. Unfortunately for Corrie, it doesn't work. You don't, there are incredibly glamorous people there and there are people with money, but it doesn't ring true that they're all living in this little back street. And I think that's the problem. And old Coronation Street got round it by not having those sort of people. Or if there were people like that with money, like, say, Mike Baldwin, well, they lived on the quays, but they had their factory in the street.
Yeah.
And that felt more realistic. Or we had Better Buys, where, and I liked Better Buys because I liked the idea that people from our little street had to go out into the big world and work in a big supermarket and then mix with people from other places. That worked. I think the smallness, but also trying to cram in like a very nice restaurant and a gym and a this and a that, has sort of worked against it for me in a strange way. Although I understand why you have to have these things in there, because you need a much bigger cast and you need a variety of locations and all those sort of things. But I just think in a strange way, Emmerdale is perhaps in a better place completely by luck. And that's no way that they thought that when they came up with it in 1972. It's ended up in a dramatically, probably a dramatically more satisfying place than Corrie at the moment.
Interesting, interesting, yeah. Emmerdale obviously started as Emmerdale Farm back in 1972. And created by Kevin Laffey, was it Kevin Laffey? I forget the guy's name.
I'll take your word for it.
It's Kev. Just call him
Kev.
I never
think of Emmerdale as being a creator, funny enough.
Yeah, it had a creator.
Obviously, we know Tony Warren and Coronation Street, but...
Yeah. Kevin Laffey. It was only supposed to run for a few weeks, and it proved to be quite popular. It's the actual series was originally called, as you will know, Gareth, Emmerdale Farm.
Indeed, that's how I remember it.
Yeah, and there's
I
been
still
several...
call it that occasionally.
Well, yeah, I think
much I do. The irritation of our lass.
There's been several Emmerdale Farms over the years.
Oh, is that so?
There has, yes. The original Emmerdale Farm from 72 to 93, which is always the one that you saw in the opening titles, that was in the story, subsidence forced them to move to a different...
Oh, I was hoping that was the one that Phil Redman flew a plane into.
No, that was subsidence. Then Hawthorne Cottage was Matt Skilbeck and Peggy's former home. That was then renamed Emmerdale Farm, and that was sold and converted into a quarry. And then the third one was Melby Farm, which went bankrupt and jumped into Annie's old cottage in the village.
Oh, very
and
nice.
And then the fourth one, which is a current Emmerdale Farm, is Butler's Farm, which was acquired by Andy Sugden and Katie.
I didn't know they actually still had an Emmerdale Farm.
I thought
they'd been so clever by dropping the farm bit and that they didn't need to have the farm anymore, that it was just Emmerdale.
Wow. You know, there was that moment after the plane crash, and the aftermath of the plane crash.
Oh, yeah, yes.
When the village was always called Beckendale, wasn't it? And then for some reason they decided to rename it Emmerdale for no real reason other than that it made sense for viewers.
We're dropping the farm bit. We've just killed all the carrot crunchers. It does seem in dubious taste now, I think about it, dropping an entire passenger plane on a village. It's one of the more radical tools of reinvention used in modern soap. And didn't our beloved Fraser Hines cop it in that one?
No, I think he died overseas. I don't think his death has actually been seen. I'm pretty sure there's scope for a Kathy Beale sort type return for Joe Sugden.
Oh, he'd love that, wouldn't he?
I'm surprised they haven't done it.
Fraser lives over North Yorkshire, doesn't he?
He does, I believe. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, that would be fun. Mind you, I suppose you see that Emmerdale did rob us of one of the more interesting things in a way, because it's because Fraser's in Emmerdale that he doesn't come into the Three Doctors.
Hmm.
That's why Sergeant Benton gets such a big part, because as Bob Baker relayed it to me, he just had to, him and Terence had to rewrite all the lines. So basically, Sergeant Benton's, which should have been the bloke who goes, "Holy Moses," at the end of whenever it is, part two, when the blobby things are coming for him.
Mm-hmm.
And then it would have been the Doctor and Jamie through the black hole.
Right.
But sadly not.
Joe's we last appearance was on...
Sorry? We moved around a bit there, but I digress.
His last appearance on Emmerdale, Fraser Hines, was Joseph Sugden's last appearance on screen was in, it was in 1993. And then in June 1995, news reached Emmerdale that he had died in a car crash. So Annie Sugden and Amos Brearley returned to the village for his funeral. So if he died in a particularly gruesome car crash...
Gosh.
It could have been the wrong person. You know, they could have been just a lookalike. It could have been someone else who nicked his card.
I wonder who Fraser upset.
I think he didn't want to go back. I think he was doing something and said, they asked him if he'd come back for something. He said, no, I'm busy doing whatever.
I went, right, you're dead.
Didn't he emigrate at one point?
Fraser?
Yeah, or am I dreaming that? Maybe I dreamt that. I was thinking he might have emigrated at some point.
No, I don't think so. I've got a feeling that because he's always had horses and been in the horse business, he's always lived in the sort of North Yorkshire.
No, you're probably right. You're probably right. But
I could be wrong on this.
As I recall it, he said he couldn't go back, so they killed him. Please
check Heinzopedia.
Is there a Heinzopedia as well?
No. But there should be.
There should be a Beckingdalepedia as well.
Yeah, I'm sure there will be a Wikipedia, isn't there? So
there's a what?
There's a dot Whopedia. Whopedia, I think.
Oh, there's
I think, isn't there? Maybe. Maybe I've got the name wrong. Anyway, I'm sure there'll be a copious Fraser Hines page in there that will explain if he did emigrate or not.
No doubt. Now, the thing about Emmerdale or Beckendale or Emmerdale Farm, you would call Emmerdale Farm, and the various locations is that... in the old days, it was kind of slow paced, but then you'd have this sort of like slow paced, relaxed sort of a show, and then you'd have like these moments of like considerable tension.
Oh yeah, we watched some scenes of that. Funny enough, and we had Louise Jameson here in Manchester a few months back, because it was one of her very first parts was in Emmerdale. In I think 72 or 73, and we pulled some clips off, and Louise is soap's very first murder victim. She's the first person to be murdered in a soap, and she plays this young girl, and it's an episode of incredible tension where for the whole episode she's out on the moors with no one around to help her, and she's being chased by this guy who eventually, after 23 minutes of real nail-biting tension, catches her and kills her.
Right.
So you're quite right. There were moments of real grit and bloodiness and brutality. And there was a certain coldness to it at times, and there was a sense that these are cold, hard, country people at heart that would... wring your neck and quietly bury you in a field and never speak of it again. And I think sometimes it captured that in the 70s. Because the countryside is a scary place full of scary people sometimes, for us softies from town.
Well, it's certainly cold up there on the moors. Or if you're stranded in the Dales, on a crag or on a hillside, on the side of someone's farm, it can get very cold up there.
But it is bleak out there.
There was another death, which was the now I've got to get this right. Jack Sugden's illegitimate son, Jackie, killed himself with a shotgun that got caught around either the gear stick or the brake lever in his Land Rover.
Oh, grim.
Yeah.
Grim. That's a step above. And I suppose what they have over something like Coronation Street is easy access to firearms in Emmerdale. That's something that Emmerdale has over Coronation Street, and there's easy access to shotguns.
It does. The thing is, Coronation Street,
you don't have Ken Barlow go to the cupboard under the stairs and get out his Remington.
Well,
give it a nice polish and storm off to the pub to sort out that Ken but that Mike Baldwin monster.
Maybe he should have done.
Well, do you know, I have a theory as well. If you watch the early 70s, Corrie, which is a weird period, that actually it's a Western, that the whole thing is Western.
Right.
Well, think about it. You have a street. So you have a street like you would in Tombstone. Yeah. Yeah. You have the saloon. You got the shop. You got the houses. All the big rows always happen high noon style in the street. You've got Ken Barlow, who's the sheriff. You've got Mike Baldwin, who's the evil man in black. And then you've got all the other characters. All we're missing is an Undertaker. But let's be honest. let's be honest. You know, I think that, you know, Alf Roberts more or less used to fulfill that role. I'm convinced that you could do Coronation Street as a Western. Convinced.
What would you call it?
Coronation, population 110. Anyway, we've moved back onto Corrie there. I've stolen the oxygen out of this rich Emmerdale discussion. So let's go back to that.
Well, the thing about Emmerdale as well, it has these disasters, whereas Coronation Street has had a couple of disasters over the years, like fires in the pub and
tram crashes
driven by the milkman from Doctor Who.
Yeah, 60s train crash.
And that one as well, yeah, that's right, yeah. But it also attracts serial killers in a way that Emmerdale doesn't.
It did go quite murdery, I think. Yeah, that's true. If there's one criticism I've got of Coronation Street in the last 10 years, is it's gone very murdery. Where are you from, a little town?
Me?
Yes.
Yes.
I am as well. I'm from Llandudno, a little town. And I can think of two people who were murdered while I was living there. One was like a pretty horrific murder,
right,
in a house on New Year's Eve. And that was forever known as the murder house. Mm. That was just how it worked. Had it been a pub, it would have been the murder pub.
I can think of one murder that happened quite recently, in the last year or so, in which more than one person was killed.
Mm.
But that's the only one I can think of in 40 years of living and being alive and living here, yeah, and knowing, yeah, people. None of the people I know have been murdered. I just know that this one occurred.
Yeah.
So I don't actually know anyone.
Murder is a big deal. If we lived in the street, we'd all know at least half a dozen people who were murdered.
Mm.
And if you've been there as long as Rita, you'd know probably a dozen people who'd been murdered.
Mm.
You know, it'd be like downtown Detroit. So I think murder as a dramatic tool is really overused, and that would be a good thing if they could get away from that, because there are so many satisfying dramatic possibilities other than murder. And I think, and maybe they are moving away, because there do seem to be less murders now. I think Kylie Platt was murdered about 3-4 months ago, and that actually felt more realistic, because she was stabbed in a row, and that, I think, is generally how lots of things like this happen. It wasn't a sort of serial killery thing. It was a random act of violence that ended nastily. Now, it'd be nice to think that we don't have another murder now for many, many years, and we deal with other things.
Yeah, it would. It's interesting that you mentioned about how Emmerdale's kind of accidentally written itself into kind of societal relevance, whereas Coronation Street is kind of heading in the other way, because at the same time, EastEnders is heading in the other way as well.
It is. Although I think EastEnders, I suppose, it's always been a little bit more diverse in its population in many ways.
Mm.
Although, isn't it irritating that everyone, to a T, in EastEnders supports West Ham? I've never seen a Man United shirt.
Well, it used to be Walford United, didn't it?
No, they're all Emmers now.
Are they?
The Mitchells are all Emmers. Richie was famously an Emmers. You know, I think, who's got the Danny Dyer? They're all Emmers.
Yeah.
You know, there's the Leighton Orient strips, or the Man United strips, or the Chelsea strips. Seems to be a lot of Chelsea down there when I go. So, you know, it's very nice for West Ham and this superior product placement. You know, while Danny Dyer's walking around in his West Ham onesie. And football doesn't really come into the other soaps, although it did in the 70s in Coronation Street.
Yeah.
The Rovers is a Man City pub in the 70s.
Right.
Always subtle, but every year in the Rovers, and I'm guessing this must be someone on the set dressing or the camera crew, always used to put up a Man City team poster on the wall.
Right.
You know, the one where they're all sat there, you know, on the benches.
Yeah.
With whatever tin cup they haven't won that year. It's a Rovers pub. But yeah, only West Ham. West Ham appears to be the only club that exists in EastEnders.
The other thing about EastEnders and Coronation Street as well, I think increasingly, is that, like, economically, the people don't appear to, like, if you live near them, these people would, you know, it would be a council house, or everyone would have lived there for like 40 years because they wouldn't be able to buy those houses otherwise.
That's true. That's certainly a problem for Emmerdale. It is a problem for Emmerdale.
Now, because I think because of the people have lived there for a long time, or they turn up and they're quite rich, so they're like moving into these big houses.
Well, yes, okay, that's true. That is true. For EastEnders, it is. I remember being quite impressed when the Slaters turned up thousands of years ago, because that did feel realistic. You know, Charlie Slater was a cabbie. He had all these kids and they all kind of just squeezed into this little house. So that felt quite realistic, actually. Mm. But you're right. You'd have to have a pretty good job, wouldn't you, to live in Walford now?
Yeah, totally. Totally. Yeah.
But not so much in Coronation Street.
Well, you say there is that. I mean, there is a difference, obviously, because it's a different location, different like house prices.
Yeah.
But at the same time, like new people buying the house for the first time, That is a problem for people now.
I guess so. I suppose the only way you can deal with it is to just ignore it.
Ignore it, yeah, absolutely.
But it is... I remember... of course, Coronation Street was on the cards to end in 1975.
Oh, was it really?
I remember being told, yeah. And there's a... and I found a little bit of press snippets around this when I was researching Jack Rosenthal, when we did a stage performance of two of his 60s episodes of Coronation Street. Mm-hmm. And in there was a wonderful cutting from the from the Daily Express, where they said, look, you know, we understand Coronation Street might be coming to a close because it no longer reflects current life. You know, all of the backstreet slums are being cleared. It's becoming tower blocks and people are moving out of these areas. It's an anachronism, and we have a feeling that Granada are going to finish it. And so what they did, they went to a selection of writers and said, how would you end Coronation Street if you've got to end it? And a couple of the answers were quite trite, and some said, oh, it'll never end. You know, they were the right ones. And the best answer was from the late Carl Alain. And she really thought about it. And she said, well, the thing is, you can't end something like Coronation Street just straight away. You'd have to really think about it. She said, so I would need a year to finish Coronation Street, but I'd finish it. And she said, and what I would do, I'd start the year with news that the street is to be cleared and that everything's going to be demolished.
Yeah.
And I would just use all of the characters to react to that. I'd have older characters who would almost sort of bunker in and would not be moved. She said, I'd have some of the older characters becoming more accepting of it and then moving away, but sad that they're not going to live near their friends and moving to new tower blocks and things like that. She said, I'd have the younger characters actually very excited about the potential of moving into these marvellous, shiny new tower blocks. And she said, and gradually I'd work it all out over the year, and then I would end it with a big party in the Rovers where everyone goes their separate ways. And she said, that's how I would end Coronation Street. And I think it's as beautiful an ending as I can think.
Mm. They should keep that on the file just in case.
They should. Of course, now it'll never end. Although the format of 25 minutes, six times a week, may well change.
Well, I was going to ask you about this, actually, because, you know, back in the day, it was on twice a week, Mondays and Wednesdays. I think that's right. And then over the years, from sort of 1990 or so onwards, there's been more and more episodes of Coronation Street, hasn't there?
Very different. Mondays and Wednesdays, yeah. Yeah, it's more and more and more and more and more.
So you have more episodes, which means more writers, more cast, more locations.
Yeah.
And does it water it down?
I think it presents a challenge. And it puts pressure on cast members who are very, very much in demand. That's for sure. You know, let's say you are continually carrying lots and lots of storylines, then the time you've got to rehearse and learn your lines, it really, you know, it's really compacted. So I think it is difficult. It means you've got to have a large standing cast, which means that not everyone's being played, but it means that they can't do other things. I think that is difficult, but the format has endured because no one's come up with a better way of doing it.
It certainly develops. So you know, when we were talking earlier, one of the reasons we picked these two soaps is because they have, that obviously didn't start at the same time, but they've had considerable developments over the years on ITV. Changed in different ways and evolved in locations, as we said. And obviously, I know that Gareth knows quite a bit about classic Coronation Street. He's enjoyed classic Coronation Street in recent years. But I know that classic Coronation Street, certainly that late 70s period, is there's a lot of humour in it.
Mm.
But there isn't so much humour in Emmerdale, only in the sort of last maybe 15, 20 years or so. That's been a very big aspect. It was like more caricatures and archetypes been introduced into Emmerdale. Than there was originally, you know, but that's kind of its regeneration in 1993 or whenever.
Yeah, I mean, the Dingles became a lot more lighthearted, and whereas they were sort of, you know, scary, you know.
They're like a Daleside mafia when they first arrived. Yeah,
that's right. Yeah, if you upset them, you end up in a shallow grave. Now, and then they became quite light and amusing. And then they introduced a couple of dotty old bats, and that helped.
Always helps.
You know, it's the Blanche Hunt maxim. You know, it's a evil old Madame Guillotine, and ideally have two so that they can feud. You know, it's a time honoured formula, and I think Emmerdale got that.
But I do wonder if back in the 70s, the only real sort of, you know, Manchester being like the home of Coronation Street.
Mm.
I do wonder if really Yorkshire's only answer to Coronation Street was Last of the Summer Wine.
Ooh, I think you're onto something there.
I think I might be.
I think you're onto something. And those early Last of the Summer Wines are pretty dark.
Mm. Yeah, they're very grim. Three old men facing retirement.
Facing death. Fighting banality.
Yeah.
And a lot of youth unemployment. And it shows the dark underbelly of life in some of these picture box villages where perhaps there isn't any work. and there's no future and no one can afford a house. And if you leave school at 16 and you've got no qualifications, then it's the glue factory 50 miles away or it's nothing.
Yeah.
That's true. That dark underbelly is certainly there. I think you might be onto something there with Last of Summer Wine.
I'm actually going to put a link in the show notes, dear listener, to a blog about Last of the Summer Wine, which because Last of the Summer Wine hasn't always been, I know it's obviously ended now, but it wasn't always that kind of...
Three men in a bathtub going down a hill.
Yeah, pretty much so.
Did they ever go down a hill in a bathtub? They must have done.
I don't know. I remember one where they built...
It's become the enduring shorthand for that show.
I remember one where they built a submarine for Compo to go in the Beck for some reason. I remember pedder-powered submarine.
They must have gone down the hill in a bath. Yeah, they must have done. I remember seeing it, but is it one of these fake memories? Like floating heads in jars in Brain of Morbius and things like that, which when you see it just aren't there, but they're in the target.
Yeah. I generally don't know whether it's real or not, but the broadcaster and writer Bob Fisher's got a very good blog about watching Last of the Summer Wine from the beginning. And certainly the first sort of 8-10 years or so is very different to what it was and towards its end. So it's a lot grimmer, a lot more socially relevant. And
it must have different music, because as I remember Last of the Summer Wine, it always has that sort of very light, sort of fluty, you know,
all
comedy sitcom music. Yeah.
Yeah, there isn't much of that.
No. You sort of like, you know, there's almost like a, you know, it'll be Compo does something, he thinks he's got away with it. Then you have a close-up on Nora Batty, then a close-up back on Compo where he's pulling his ee face, and then there's a, you know, sort of, you know, and that appears to be the formula that they ended up with, which is, you know, it is good for light comedy, not so good for drama.
Not so good for drama, no. But I certainly feel it works better in the old days, anyway, than it did later on.
Right. Do we end on a recommendation then, as we do in your other place, the podcast with the K?
Oh, the podcast with the K. Well, we can. I mean, well, no, actually, what I was going to say, because it's coaxial and we do talk about TV, and I've got a couple of ideas about it, which I'm going to talk to you about, Gareth, later. But I did think it might be good if we could have a little sort of, because we are talking about just television in general, a sort of what I've been watching this week sort of a thing. As a regular ending feature. What have you been watching this week?
What have I been watching this week? Well, I've been out and about a lot, so I haven't seen as much telly as I would like. I watched the series finale of Fear the Walking Dead, which has built quite nicely from quite a weak place and a fairly weak cast, actually, with a sort of grindingly earnest pair of teachers towards somewhere quite interesting, actually. And they're all in Mexico now, and they're all in a huge abandoned luxury hotel that they've cleared of zombies, and that just doesn't, you know at some point in the next series they're going to be either overrun by zombies or overrun by Mexicans with machine guns, or a combination of the two. But for now, that's quite good. So I watched that. What else did I watch when I got back? I've been rewatching The Sopranos series one, because when I rewatched it lately, I started at series two because I couldn't find series one. I found series one and I've rewatched that, and it's glorious as ever. Mm-hmm. It's Uncle Junior and Livia for me. They have all of the chemistry. So if, like me, you were prejudiced against The Sopranos because I foolishly thought, oh, I've seen this before. I've seen Goodfellas. I've seen Casino. I've seen The Godfather Part 3. I don't need this. Don't be so foolish. It's great.
Okay.
So, yeah, so that's what I've been watching this week.
Okay. Now, this week, I think, well, as I was speaking to you before, Gareth, I've been away at the weekend, so I've not had an awful lot of time for television. But what I have been doing is the continuing rewatch. Well, it's not really a rewatch, actually. It's kind of a watch, basically, of NCIS from the beginning.
Ooh.
Because Channel 5 here in the UK and Channel 5 US and CBS Action, they never put them on in order. So when they're playing it, they play
it's a bit,
maybe
that's a bit rum, isn't it?
It's a pain in the backside. They play maybe five because they put so many of them on, right? So maybe you could be watching it from 8 till midnight.
It's like watching Doctor Who in the '70s in Nigeria. Oh, it's Jamie. Where's Jamie gone? Oh, hello, Jamie.
Oh. Yeah, it's like they might be consecutive episodes, but if you don't have the time to watch 4 hours of TV in one sitting, or if you do, but you're going to watch it in a different way, you maybe just have time to, or you don't even know that they're playing for because they change the schedules that often. You don't know how many they're playing on a go. You end up dipping in and out of it. So what we decided to do was watch it from the beginning. And we're currently episode 16 in the first series. It's interesting how quickly it crystallizes the characterizations. Because long running shows, they can change over time quite considerably. But with NCIS, you've got the fantastic David McCallum, who's 83.
Never.
Yeah.
It was a while ago. Man from Uncle was a fair lick ago.
He was in his 30s then. Yeah, but there's a great line in one of the first series episodes where. What did Dr. Mallard look like when he was younger? And Gibbs, Mark Harmon's character, the leader of the NCIS team, says he looked like Ilya Kuryakin. Which is a great line.
That's a great line, though.
Yeah. So we're watching that from the beginning. So, yeah, you've got Gibbs as this kind of very, very sort of moral and determined and rarely shares what's going on in his head. You've got DiNozzo, who's he's now Michael Weatherly. He's now left the show just this year. Shows how long it's been going. As a kind of wisecracking, womanizing character, but there's a lot more to him than that. He's also very needy, in terms of validation of whether he's doing a good job or not. And you've got Abby, the forensic girl, and you've got at this point you haven't got McGee, he's just a occasional character, but you've got Caitlin, who's like the intro character who takes you into NCIS. She joins the NCIS from a job in the Secret Service working on Air Force One in the first episode, so she's very much your gateway into NCIS. But it's interesting how, although she's now left, the sort of the main four or five characters have barely changed over the years, and yet the show is still remarkably watchable. I think it's because it's had such a great ensemble cast.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, it's a great success story, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it was spun off from another show called Jack, with a similar sort of setting, or legal. But I think I think the reason it does so well is because obviously it came out at the same time, or a little bit after CSI. And that's another great line, actually, in the first episode or the second episode. There's a question, what is NCIS like CSI? And DiNozzo says, only if you're dyslexic.
Oh, brutal.
CSI is very much a kind of... It's
more
changes
procedural,
a lot,
isn't it?
It's a lot of it's made up, and I think NCIS is guilty of that a bit as well. But I think CSI is very procedural, but it can also be very much obvious killer of the week or obvious staff problem of the week, and then you've got some
that's why I gave up on the blacklist because that felt exactly like that,
right?
Although James Spader was good, but the rest of it now I could leave.
But I think NCIS gets around that by having such strong central performances and having that strong ensemble cast, which CSI hasn't managed to do really beyond, you know, the leaders and of each CSI department or whatever. But NCIS has been what I've been watching this week, and there's 300 plus episodes of it now, so I might be watching it for quite some time.
My goodness. My word. We'll see you in 2019.
Good well be. Okay. Well, thank you for tuning in to this week's, our second coaxial. And if you have any suggestions for any topics we could be chatting about TV, primarily British TV, but not necessarily, do let us know via Twitter to the Beyond Casterbris, because we're a Beyond Casterbris podcast. I should have mentioned that earlier. So you can get in touch with us on Twitter at CasterBeyond. And you can drop us an email to podcasterbris@gmail.com. That's a thing I need to sort out, the email addresses for all these new podcasts. From Gareth and myself, until next time, it's goodbye.
Keep watching. Hello.
Good morning.
Ah, we're on the air. Marvellous. Good morning. We love a good morning.
Good morning. Pissing by the lake. I'm just making a cup of tea. I'm trying the kettle to boil. Do you know? I've been making tea wrong all my life, or all of my tea making life.
Go on.
We ran out of tea. Now usually I let Kerry buy the tea because it comes from the Ringtons man who goes to her mum's house. So it just comes in that way. So it's never really big deal buying tea. And I have decaf tea. But we didn't have any. And you know everything that was going on at the weekend and that. I thought, well, she hasn't got time to sort this out. I'll just go out and buy some tea. So I went out and bought some tea. I eventually found some decaf tea. Brought it home. Plopped my tea bag in a cup. Just happened to glance at the back of the side of the box and noticed there's all these complicated instructions. Like,
no.
Yeah, like using a freshly filled kettle rather than relying on the previous water that was in the kettle because there's more oxygen in freshly filled kettle. And also, when you add the water still has to be boiling. Like, it still has to be bubbling in the kettle when you add it into the tea, into the cup.
Yeah.
I didn't know this.
Oh, I always do that.
No, I don't. Well, I do now. I didn't before. I do now.
I've never done this reboil the fresh kettle thing. Although,
no, never reboil the kettle.
That's what I mean. But I am tight, so I only put like the minimum in.
Yeah, well, I do that as well. Yeah,
if it's just me in the house, so you probably need.